Hope you enjoyed that first session. Great to chat with some of you during the break and just hear some of the insights and the things that resonated with you, which is cool. Before we move into this second session and unpack the other two elements of the equation for momentum, any questions? Any comments? Any points for clarification? Because we did cover a lot very quickly in that first session. So questions? Yeah. Every couple of days there'll be new stuff. So the comment was how recently updated. And yeah, it's every few days, particularly if you're looking at the trends in business. I mean, you just can't stand still. I was reading this morning about the challenges Telstra's had this week. 8,000 staff being laid off and why that's the case. And a couple of schools of thought as to what they're doing, but that's an interesting case. I mean, GE, we talked about Jack Welch, the quote from him. GE fell out of the Dow this week, the Dow 100, which is a massive move. So some interesting stuff happening in this space. This is, in fact, you speak to probably the biggest challenge for me is you write books about business trends, and for the moment you finish writing it to when the publishers get their act together to launch it, stuff changes. So it is a constant challenge to keep up. So it's a good point. Any other questions or comments or points for clarification? Yeah. Ah, bless your heart. You're welcome. It's my pleasure. Well, great. So you've already had a good morning, so everything's a bonus from here, isn't it? That's good. Well, good. Thank you. I'm glad. I'm really glad it's useful. It's great. Thank you. Anything else before we move on? If not, let's recap. Before the break, we talked about this first element of the equation, activity. And who remembers the four things I said you need to ask? Are our activities, what was the first one? Are they inspired? Number two, are activities innovative? Are they number three? Intentional. And number four, are they intergenerational? Of those four, if you look at the one that's the biggest challenge for you in your business, hands up if it's making sure your activities are inspired that is the biggest challenge for you, making sure you stay on point, connected to the why. Okay, a couple of you, great, thank you for being honest. What about the whole innovative approach? Staying innovative is a big challenge for you. Anyone in that category? A few of you, interesting. Okay, what about being intentional, not falling into the trap of just doing it the way it's always done? Okay, quite a few. What about the intergenerational piece? Lots of you. That's interesting. And the reality is, for you guys as a business and an industry, this next generation are a massive opportunity. They really are. I mean, you've got a generation who want to work for themselves. They've been raised and schooled to think that way. Like, don't get a job for life. Be your own boss. Question, yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Mhm. Haha. Gets a good point. Yeah. Sure. Okay. So the question was, they ask why all the time, and then when you give the answer, in some cases they don't listen because you feel like you're taking too long to deliver it. Could also be bless you. Could also be the tone behind the answer. So this is important. If you look at the mentality that shaped the millennials or the Gen Ys. One of the key societal shifts that's happened in their lifetime is the shift toward postmodernism. So postmodernism is a worldview that says truth is not absolute, truth is relative. So what's true for you is based on your experience, what's true for me is based on my experience. There's no such thing as black and white, it's all about shades of grey, this age of relativism. So when they ask why, one of the reasons they ask why is what they mean by it, what is the perception that's led you to make that judgment? In other words, what's your version of truth? What have you perceived or seen? And yet, for older generations, which is called a modernist mindset, when you were raised being told there's right and wrong, moral absolutes, this whole notion, the sense was that there, if there's right and wrong, well then what's right, I can prove to you because there's evidence, there's research, or there's a moral imperative. But when you give evidence and research or the moral imperative to a younger generation as the answer to the why question, it bounces off or goes over their heads. The best way to communicate truth to coach, to train, to teach a postmodern generation is through narrative. Tell them your stories, share your experiences. That's what works, because what a story does is it takes a truth, the message you want to get through, and puts it in the context of your own experience. It applies it to your life. And for this generation, I mean, they'll resist your judgment, what you think they should do. But they're far more open to your journey, like what you've done, what you've learned. And by the way, not just the good stories, the bad ones. If you want your young team members to stick at the business, you tell them stories of the times when you've wanted to quit, when you felt overwhelmed, out of your depth, discouraged, and you tell them the stories of when you stuffed it up. That's what will resonate. That's what will teach them most. I mean, from a faith perspective, narrative is the most potent teaching tool. I mean, if you look at any great religious teacher, but Jesus is the best, it was all narrative driven. It's all about stories, because stories take the principle from the head and get it to the heart. And so with a postmodern generation that's vital, absolutely vital, the way you respond, the tone, the motivation behind it, you need to be clear on what that is. Sometimes that'll be the reason you're sort of butting heads. So, because, you know, what often happens, by the way, is the word you hear a modernist generation say the most is the word should. You should do X, Y, or Z. You say should, they ask why. The way you respond is critical. If you dismiss the question of why from them, you know what dismissals normally sound like? Because I said so. Right? Well, because that's just the way it's done. That, I mean, that's a red rag to a bull for a postmodern generation. So that's a good question. All right, so we've talked about these questions for are your activities and then measuring them against those four things. Let's now talk about the other two ingredients or elements of this equation for building and keeping. And keeping is the key part. And keeping momentum, okay? The F in this formula stands for the word focus. We've talked about focus a few times and a few of you mentioned focus before. And it's hard to overstate the importance of focus in getting breakthrough results in anything in life, but particularly in your business, in this style of business. Focus is challenging but vital. Because you know what focus does? Focus gives your activity intensity. Write that down if you can come back to reflect on that. Focus gives activity intensity. It's a bit like when you focus the rays of the sun. The rays that were already quite powerful become ultra powerful and can burn through things. And that's the important part of focus. I love this insight from Ralph Waldo Emerson. He said, the successful person is merely the average person focused. You look at who gets success in this business or any business, it's not necessarily because they're smarter, not even necessarily because they worked harder than anyone else, but because they were more focused for longer than anyone else. And so to get to the Caribbean is going to require, above other things, focus in the next 12 months. Now, the reality is, though, if we're really honest, focus, concentration is under siege today. It is more difficult today than ever before to focus, to get into that flow state where momentum builds. In fact, a bit of a pop quiz here. According to a recent study, and this study would now be probably 2 years ago, conducted by Microsoft, what is the average adult's attention span today, do you think? I'll give you four options. Do you reckon it's 2 minutes, 45 seconds, 12 seconds, or 8 seconds? Who'd go that, you know, I reckon probably the attention spans are the 2 minutes. Who'd go for 2 minutes as the attention span today? Anyone? Only one. I love the optimist at the back. 2 minutes. Yeah, we're pretty good as humans. Yeah, 2 minutes. All right. Who's going to go for 45 seconds? All right. Okay, a few more. Who's going to really lowball and go, okay, let's go 12 seconds? All right, and who are the real pessimists here? Like, oh man, 8 seconds is probably about where it's at. Okay, quite a few of you. All right, now this is where it gets interesting. When this study was first done in the year 2000, the result was 12 seconds. When that was repeated 16 years later, 2 years ago, it had slumped to 8 seconds, the average attention span for an adult human. And what's interesting, by the way, to put this into context or perspective, that means we have an attention span 1 second less than the average goldfish, okay? I'll show you a picture and just to lock that in a couple of moments because it's true. And it's interesting, when I travel around the world at conferences, I find there are sort of like, speaking of this whole theme of focus, there are two types of people in every audience. There's the people who love to volunteer. Like when I say I need a volunteer, they like stand to their feet, they raise their arm, they're like, it's my moment to shine. You know, I love volunteering. And the other group of people who are the ones who don't like to volunteer. Who are the volunteers? Who loves to volunteer? Like, I love that there are people like you out there. Who are the second group who are like me, who are like, when I say volunteer, like, don't make eye contact, don't bother me, I don't want you to come anywhere near me. Who's in that category? Probably wouldn't raise your hand, would you? But it's interesting. I was at a conference a few years ago, and the speaker up on the stage at this event said, I need a volunteer, and a whole lot of the keen beans jumped up. And he said, the thing was, I need a volunteer who wears glasses. Oh, that's interesting. You know, people wearing glasses streamed down from the stands. The first guy on stage was a guy that looked a bit like this. His name was Don. And in fact, the speaker interviewed him, asked him where he was from, a bit of his background. And he said, Don, you've got great glasses there, like the Coke bottle variety glasses. He said, you'll be perfect for this. And I thought, this is interesting. I wonder where this is going. Anyway, the speaker handed Don a copy of the day's newspaper, and he opened to about page 4 where the font starts to get pretty small. And he said, okay, Don, I want you to just tell me how much of this you can read. And Don had to read through, read a few sentences, and I said, okay, that's cool. He said, now, here's what I want you to do next. Take your glasses off and just pass them to me if you wouldn't mind. And he said, look back at the newspaper. He said, how much can you read now? And poor Don, you could see him getting a bit flustered, like the sort of red throat, nervous, sort of clammy thing. He was a bit uncomfortable. He said, I can't hardly even make out the heading, much less anything else there. And this is where it got really interesting. The speaker then put a sheet of black cardboard over the newspaper and said, okay, Don, we'll leave your glasses off for a moment, but have a look again and tell me what you can see. Put this black cardboard over the newspaper, and Don had a look again and said, that is extraordinary. Even with his glasses off, with eyesight as bad as his, when he looked through the little slit in this cardboard, he could make out the words crystal clear. And he slid it across and he read a whole sentence. I remember asking my optometrist afterwards, how is that possible, a man with such poor eyesight? And she said, well, it's the same principle behind pinhole glasses back in the day. What this does is this actually removes what they call circles of confusion from around the retina. These things distract your eye from being able to focus. Now, and I love that one of you at the back's trying it right now just to test it and see. That's beautiful. And so the interesting thing is it's not just in our eyesight this is happening. This is happening for all of us on a daily basis. It's the level of distraction around us that means we have an attention span 1 second less than the average goldfish. That's what's going on. You know, weapons of mass distraction, I tend to call them. And it's true. Like, there's just so much stuff going on. And technology is a big part of this. I mean, in fact, I want you to do a bit of a stock take right now. If you were to add up every screen in your household, we're talking not just you, but your spouse or your partner or your kids, every screen owned by someone in your household, we're talking iPads or tablet devices, we're talking laptops, TVs, smartphones, the screen that's in the dashboard of your car, your smart watches. If you were to add up every screen in your household, just start doing a bit of a tally. Maybe you've got a number in front of mind now, how many that would be. Can I get you to stand if it's more than five? If it's more than five screens in your household, could you please stand up? All right, that's lots of us. Okay, stay standing if it's more than 10, just out of curiosity. More than 10? Okay, what about more than 12? Anyone got more than 12? Uh-oh, here we go. How many? So we've got only three standing. How many do you reckon you've got? Yep. About 15 to 16 screens. Perfect. Thank you. What have you got? Can you beat that? About 18 screens. One. And what have you got? 15. Thank you. Grab a seat. Now, what's interesting, I challenge you, go back and do a stock take. I reckon the number may well be double what you just estimated for a lot of us. And it's not just the volume of the screens we're around that's impacting our ability to focus and concentrate, our attention spans. It's how addicted we've become to them. I wonder how many of you have walked into a cafe or a restaurant and encountered a scene a little bit like this in the past. Who secretly judges people who does this in cafes and restaurants? Who judges them? Some of you are like, I don't even secretly, I just judge them. Like some of you. Now, I do too, until I catch myself doing the same thing. And that's the danger zone. In fact, I remember a few years ago, I was speaking at a conference on Hamilton Island, and I'd never been before. And I was speaking on a Wednesday morning and I arrived at like the Tuesday afternoon flight, so I had a few hours spare. And I was reading through a little compendium in the hotel room and it said things to do on Hamilton Island. I thought I should check this out, I haven't been before. One of the things it said you must do is climb to the top of Passage Peak at sunrise. Now, Passage Peak is the mountain at the eastern end of the island. It's the highest point in the Whitsundays. Anyone climbed Passage Peak here just out of curiosity? Anyone know what I'm talking about? Well worth doing. Amazing. Anyway, so next morning, I checked out the time the sun would rise. It was like 5:25. I'm like, oh, that's commitment. I'm like, okay. Set the alarm for 4:30. Got out of bed, threw some exercise clothes on, went out the back of the hotel through this little gate and onto a path that sort of led up the mountain. It took 45 minutes to get to the top of this mountain. Pitch black darkness. And it was good to have my phone with me because I was using it as a torch for the first 20 minutes because it was just completely dark. I remember looking at the sun, looking at the time, looking at the horizon, thinking, I've got to get up there before the sun actually rises, otherwise it's all a bit of a waste of time. And I remember the last little bit, you sort of hurl yourself up on top of this rocky outcrop, the last little bit to get on top of the mountain. And as I flung myself up on top of this mountain, looked at the horizon, there was just a thin line of orange. I just made it about 2 minutes before the sunrise occurred, and I sat down and just watched it. And it was just like beautiful, warm morning, gentle breeze, no one else around. And this was the scene that I encountered. It's hard to see on that screen, but it was just glorious morning. But this is where it got dangerous. This was the messy bit. I took this photo and then I thought, well, you know, if it's not on Facebook, did it really happen? You know, so I'll just upload the photo to Facebook and say, awesome sunrise, Lord Howe Island, blah, 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 hashtag something. Anyway, so did this, but that's where it got messy because I opened my phone, uploaded this to Facebook, and then saw there were a few notifications, and I just checked out what the notifications were, and then There was a link to a news story, so I went and read the news story. Then I thought, oh, I'm here, so I'll just check my emails. I was waiting on some emails come through overnight from a colleague in America, and then I thought, I'll go back and see how many likes I got for the photo, because that's, of course, part of the deal. And then I looked down and I looked at the clock on my phone, and it had been 11 minutes. I'd have been staring at my screen. I missed almost the entire sunrise. Something I woke up at 4:34, but this inability to just be in the moment and be contented. I mean, who finds themselves increasingly like this? Who's in that situation, if we're really honest? This inability to just focus, just be in the moment and not feel we need a distraction. And this is not having just an impact on our mental health. And by the way, it is having an impact on our mental health. If you look at the Greek word, the ancient Greek word for anxiety, the root Greek word is actually the word merinma, and it means to be scattered or shattered, to be splintered. Now, it's interesting that most of us feel anxious because our attention is splintered in a million different ways at any given moment. A lot of the mental health stuff we're seeing is a function of this age where we're never able to just be in the moment and switch off and focus. Now, interestingly, it's having some physical impacts as well. Last year, if you look at research from Pew Research, 8,000 pedestrians in the US wandered into traffic and were hit by a car, seriously injured or killed, because they were so distracted by their phones, they had no idea what was happening around them. Now, I love this little video I grabbed off YouTube the other week, and I thought it was just gold, because it shows what happens when distracted people encounter life in public settings, okay? Have a look at this. It's not good to laugh, but sometimes it's fun. It's a person falling into a shopping mall water feature. This person into a manhole on the street. Love this woman. Falls over in a lobby of a car park. And this is my favourite guy. Look at this dude here. Straight into a car. Now, this has become so serious. They've actually started using street signs now in some busy built-up areas around Europe. And this is what they look like. To warn drivers of hotspots where people are distracted, unable to focus. Now, from a business or a professional perspective, this inability to focus is huge. In fact, if you look at the data, University of California, Irvine, 4 years ago, released some research which showed the average office worker today is distracted or self-distracts, that's the key part, every 3.5 minutes. And some of you are like, man, that'd be a dream to even get 3.5 minutes without being interrupted if you work in an office. 3.5 minutes on average. Now, here's the kicker. It takes 23 minutes to get back to the point of focus. Being as focused in flow state, which is where momentum builds, takes 23 minutes to get back to the point of focus. So you do the numbers. If you're getting interrupted every 3.5 minutes, it takes 23 minutes to get back to the point of focus. Is it any wonder we feel like we're spinning our wheels, never getting traction, never getting into that flow state? I mean, we said in the first session, there's no point going 100 miles an hour if you're heading the wrong direction. You know, there's no point going 20 miles an hour in 5 different directions either. And yet that's the challenge so many of us face. We're so split, so distracted. Now, for a few moments, I want you to reflect just with the person next to you. If you think about your daily life, what is your single biggest daily distraction? What is the stuff that prevents you from getting into this focused flow state where momentum forms? So maybe just with the person next to you first, just 20 seconds, what's the biggest distraction for you? Go for it. Okay, 5 seconds to go. 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Now, you guys look like a relatively normal group, so let's see how normal you are, okay? Let's just test your normalness for a moment. Here are the top 5. If you look at the research, the 5 key distractions. I wonder how many of you, these were the things that you said. Number 5, social media. According to Facebook's own data, Facebook users spend 51 minutes on the app. Every day. 51 minutes. And you think, what were we spending those 51 minutes doing before Facebook? It's a lot of time. In fact, a couple of my colleagues have gotten to the point where they realised how addicted they were to Facebook, how distracting it was. They've actually deleted the apps off their phone. And not just Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. Not deleting your account or your profile, just the app. Because the problem with the app is it's so immediately accessible. You just spend so much time just scanning, scrolling on your phone, getting nothing much done. Okay, so first one, social media. Number 4, the 4th biggest one is work colleagues. If you work in an office environment, This is a massive one. Most open plan offices today are a nightmare for focus and momentum because there's constant interruptions. And it's funny how we spent so much money making every office in the world open plan. Now we've discovered just how dumb it is from a productivity perspective, okay? It's good for economics, but bad for productivity. Number three, meetings. It's the number of meetings people are in on a daily basis at work. Who said this? Who had this as one of their ones in their discussion? Anyone have this one? It's huge. This is so big in some corporations, they're actually trying to combat the number of meetings people are in. There's a company in the US called Edmunds.com, and they've had these things they've instigated 2 years ago called Thinking Thursdays. On Thursday, in their offices, you cannot call a meeting. You're not allowed, no internal meetings. They wanted to have one day where people could just focus on creative work and not get distracted by having to race from one meeting to another, particularly when half the meetings weren't even necessary. I saw these awesome ribbons that were being handed out recently. It was a little ribbon that was like, congratulations, I survived another meeting that could have been an email. And I thought that was just brilliant. Number two, phone calls, constant interruptions from the phone. And number one, big one was email. Who said email was the biggest distraction for you? Okay, that is number one, the biggest one. Do you know the average employee today spends 28% of any given day responding to email? A lot of time in reactive mode. It's having a huge impact. Now, were there any that weren't mentioned there? What are your biggest distractions that weren't in that top five list? Yeah.
My toddler.
Your toddler.
I'm hungry, I need a snack.
Yeah. Yeah, your toddler. There's not much I can do to help with that one, but yes, it's true. Your toddler, absolutely. Perfect. Yeah, thank you. What did you say? Was it your toddler as well?
The garden.
Oh, the garden. I mean, this is the thing. That often the things that distract us are not bad things, they're good things, but you know, it's within the right context. Yeah, thank you. What was yours?
Having to stop to eat or go to the toilet.
Get this man a colostomy bag, he can just keep working. Having to stop to go to the toilet, I love it. Perfect, thank you. What was yours? The TV. I mean, it's constantly there. Now, of course, there's just so much more content, isn't there, with Netflix. There's no end to the distractions available. And that's the interesting thing. It's not just about technology. I mean, look at the example of the garden. It's not just technology that distracts us from getting to this flow state. It's often the number of things we try to do at once. I love this insight, the old Russian proverb, and it's so true. Russians said this, if you chase two rabbits, you'll catch neither. Isn't that profound? And by the way, most of us aren't chasing two things at once, we're chasing 20 or 200 things at once. It's called multitasking. And we like to think we're really good at multitasking, but we're not. The data's compelling. People who multitask are 40% slower and get far worse results. They miss things, mistakes are made. I love this insight from an award-winning photographer, Steve Uzell, who says this, multitasking is merely the opportunity to screw up more than one thing at once. Oh, that is so true. So bearing in mind all of the distractions we've got around us on a daily basis, how do you focus? How do you manage this stuff and get to the point where as you're building a business, particularly when you've got family around, I mean, just family and the realities of life, how do you try and achieve focus? Okay, and three quick tips to doing this. The first one, if you want to jot these down, these might be useful to take back to your teams as well. First key to achieving focus is you need to switch off and shut out. You need to start setting some boundaries proactively as an adult. Take some responsibility and control what you allow into your world. This may well mean, as we said, some of my colleagues are doing this, deleting the Facebook or the Instagram app off your phone. Just get rid of it. It may well mean that for certain times throughout the day, you switch your phone to flight mode so you're unavailable. Or you switch your email, you shut your email program down. I was talking with Chris Luxon, who's the CEO of Air New Zealand recently, and Chris is a very switched-on guy. And he said one of the most helpful things he's found over the years for being productive is he said, I batch my emails. I only check email four times a day for 20 minutes at a time. In between that, I shut my email program down and set the out-of-office notification to say to people I'm not checking email until a set time. He said, that's the most important thing. He said, if I don't do that, I spend my entire day reacting to the urgent. And he said, the great thing as a leader, and by the way, those of you who have with significant, large downline teams, the great thing he said is, when they know I'm unavailable, they find the solutions to their own problems. This is important. If you want to empower a team of distributors, if you are always available, they'll never find their own answers because you're always just a call away. Not only is it impacting your momentum because you're constantly distracted, but it's actually stunting their personal growth as well. So he said, you know, just emails and phones for a chunk of time. I get into focus mode. The door is shut, emails shut down so I can get the quality work done. Now, for those of you who find email a big challenge, one of the tools you may want to look at is one called SaneBox. SaneBox is interesting because it actually uses artificial intelligence to curate your email. So once you've got SaneBox running in the background, as emails come through, this tool learns very quickly the sort of emails for you that are urgent and important, and it lets them straight through. But the emails that it deems to be non-urgent or non-important, it quarantines, and then you set a time, maybe it's 4:45 in the afternoon, where all those emails get released in one batch. And then you deal in 15 minutes, you do a bang, 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 get through all the emails quickly rather than having them interrupt you as you go throughout your day. But if you don't want to batch your emails or your SaneBox or delete apps off your phone or any of that sort of stuff, you know the simplest thing any of you can do that will revolutionize how much focus you can achieve on a daily basis is just switch off all new message notifications on your phone for especially things like social media. Just switch off the notifications and even email. Even email. Because, you know, every time that little ping goes off to let you know a new email's arrived or a new person's posted on LinkedIn or commented on your Facebook post or whatever it is, the moment that little ping goes off, you actually get a little bit dumber. I don't know if you know this. Let's just test it, okay? Are you ready for the sound? Did you feel it? Intelligence. Let's try it again. Just feel the brain cells die in that moment. There it is, okay? You actually get dumber when that happens. Now, it's only temporary dumbness, you'd be glad to know, but you actually lose cognitive ability. Oxford University looked at this 3.5 years ago. They found the moment that alert goes off to know that an email or a notification's gone live, for women, you lose 10 basis points off your effective IQ immediately. It's only temporary, okay? It doesn't last forever, you'll be glad to know. Only temporary. For men, it's worse for us. You probably could have guessed that. Okay, we lose 15 basis points off our effective IQ the moment that happens. Why? Because the moment that alert goes off, our attention becomes split. You're working on something, that alert goes off, and your mind instantly starts thinking, who's that from? Is it from that person who I've been waiting to hear from? And suddenly, have you ever had those moments where you start inventing a whole plot line? Because if they say this, and if they've done this, I tell you what, I'm going to say this back to them. When they respond this, and you've had this whole argument in your head, and you don't even know if the email's even from them yet. Okay, and this is the challenge, is that moment, just those alerts, the difference they make to your cognitive ability to get into flow state, build momentum is huge. So just switch off new message notifications. That's the first key, switch off, shut out. Number two, second key is this. You need to have a finishing frenzy. Have a finishing frenzy. Just get stuff finished, completed, knocked on the head. Now, what we've discovered about our brains in recent years is that our brains actually operate a lot like our computers. And if your computer starts running like a dog, really slows down, you take it to a technician, the first question they will ask is, how many applications have you got running right now? How many things have you got open? And if you're like me, you'll say, well, I don't know, 5 or 6 things, you know, Word, PowerPoint, a couple of websites. And they'll say, no, not those applications. How many background applications have you got running? And if you're like me, you'll say, well, I don't know. And they'll bring up a dialog box and they'll say, do you know, right now you've got 79 background applications running on your computer. Or more. I mean, it's amazing. These things just run in the background. You don't even know they're open. And then they start to shut these applications down one by one. The moment they do, you notice your CPU performance roar back to life. Have you seen this before? Okay. And our brains are the same. Everything you've started but not completed, every task you've got underway but you've not knocked on the head and finished off, is like one of those applications running in the background, taking up your subconscious capacity, ruining your ability to focus. William James, the father of modern psychology, put it this way. He said, there is nothing as fatiguing as the eternal hanging on of an uncompleted task. Now, we know this feeling. When you've got stuff that's just there, it's lingering. You know, I've got to get that done, got to get that done, got to get that done. It's exhausting, but also it's ruining your capacity to focus because you're always thinking about the stuff you haven't finished yet. My challenge for you would be this, and if we had time, it'd be good to unpack this some more, but I'd challenge you with this notion of what is one lingering task or project you could get done in the next 24 hours? Maybe you've got 7 things you could get done in the next 24 hours, but just one. In fact, let's be accountable here. Write it down. What's the one thing you could get done in the next 24 hours that if you could just get it finished, you know it'll make a huge impact on your ability to focus, to free up headspace. I mean, for me, yesterday, I was so tired last night, so I had I don't know how long yesterday was, but landed here last night, got to the hotel room, and I had one blog post I've been halfway through writing for days. I thought, okay, practice what you preach. So I finished it. Just got it done before sleep. Because I'm like, if I don't get it done last night, I'll come into today, and then it's another day, and it'll linger. So just getting it finished. I mean, it's amazing waking up this morning knowing that blog post was done, submitted, finished. Just the difference this stuff makes. So what's one thing you can get done? Because having a finishing frenzy has a huge impact on your ability to focus on the task at hand. Okay, number three. Third key is this, you need to get really good at saying no. Who finds it hard to say no? Hands up if you do. Lots of us do. Part of it, by the way, is the people-pleasing bent in a lot of us. We want people to like us. We want to be useful. Right? Sometimes it's the Messiah complex. Like, well, if I don't say yes, if I don't help, everything will fall apart. Well, probably not. And sometimes, by the way, the things you say no to give someone else an opportunity to have a go, to step in. But saying no is hard for most of us. And by the way, saying no is not about being mean-spirited. It's about being mission-driven. Saying, if I'm going to really build my business, if I'm going to really get to the Caribbean in 12 months' time, I've got to say no. I've got to say no to helping with this committee, getting involved in this local group. I've got to say no to this TV show on Tuesday night. This requires sacrifice, saying no. I love the insight from Steve Jobs. He put it well. Steve Jobs said, focus is not saying yes to the one thing. It's saying no to the 100 other good things. That's the key. They're good things. The good is the enemy of the best. It's not like you're saying no to intrinsically bad stuff. It's things that are worthy. They're worthy of time. It's just not worthy of your time or your attention now because you're on purpose. You're on mission. I love the insight too from Tim Ferriss. How many of you are fans of Tim Ferriss's work? Anyone know Tim Ferriss's work? Only a few of you. Tim Ferriss says we need to simplify the decision-making process when it comes to saying yes or no to stuff. I love this. And Tim Ferriss, in his characteristically irreverent way, says, when you're faced with a decision, something to get involved in or not get involved in, make it a binary decision-making process. If it's not a hell yeah, it's automatically a no. And here's what this means. If you get presented with an opportunity and in your gut, you're like, if you don't know instantly, like, yeah, hell yeah, that is important. That is strategic, that is necessary. In your gut, if it's not instantly a hell yeah, it's a no. And the reason you've got to make it a simple process is because if you don't, you'll start to justify, oh, but it won't take too much time and it really is a good cause and blah, blah, blah. We start to rationalise and suddenly our plate's too full. I mean, this week, for instance, I got asked to MC some charity function and it was a good cause and all the rest of it, but I just knew gut level it just wasn't right for me. Like the week they wanted me to do it was already a massive week and I thought if I had another thing on, it's just going to be too much. And it was hard, great charity, but I said no. And it's not easy, but it's so critical if you're going to build momentum and keep it. And keep your sanity, by the way, as well. Get really good at saying no. So, we've talked about activity. We've talked about focus. The third ingredient, and it's such a key ingredient to this equation for building momentum, is the C, which stands for consistency. Some of you guessed it. That's so important. Consistency is what brings it all together. It really does. And I've probably learned the most about consistency in the last 2.5 years since becoming a dad. This is a picture of my little boy up on the screen. This is Max up on the screen. I know, isn't he cute? To his second birthday. He's a sweet little man. Interesting, I learned a lot about consistency, obviously, as a parent, and you've got toddlers now too, so you're living it as well. You know, sleep times and feed times and all that stuff in the early days, you obviously learn about the importance of consistency. But I also learned a lesson about consistency in a surprising way. And it was from rediscovering some of the books, and one in particular that I had read to me when I was a kid, and then discovering them and reading them to Max as he's now a kid, which is sort of that lovely full circle thing. And some of them are literally the books I had as a kid. They're all falling apart and dog-eared and sort of nice to read them to him. One of them, though, is this book here. Who remembers The Tortoise and the Hare from when they were a kid? Many of you do. Now, even if you don't know this story or this book, okay, in fact, if you don't know it, spoiler alert, it's about a race between a tortoise and a hare, and the tortoise wins. Okay, just spoiler alert right there. But even if you don't know the book, every one of us knows the moral to this story. What's the moral to the story? Slow and steady wins the race. We know this. Now, we know this, but many of us don't really know it because we don't do it. I mean, to know and not to do is not to know at all. Like if you know something, you're not actually living it out. You haven't actually internalized the knowledge yet. And the challenge is for most of us, consistency is a tough ask. You think about how many people set New Year's resolutions and they're really focused, they're doing all the right activities for a week or for a couple of days. Certainly no more than a month. The average person, a couple of weeks in, you've reverted back to what you're doing on December 31st. And the challenge is consistency doesn't come naturally to most of us. And you see this in the health arena. I loved this meme I saw pop up on Facebook. few years ago. I don't mean to brag, but I finished my 14-day diet in 3 hours and 12 minutes. And I love this because, I mean, who's done a diet like that? Come on, it was really good, but you didn't stick at it. And it's not that diets don't work. It's not that gyms don't work. It's that we don't work them long enough to get results. See, as human beings, we always drift. We will naturally drift. That's at the core of this theme of the law of entropy we started our time talking about. We'll come back to that at the end. But here's the key principle. We never drift toward discipline. You just don't. I mean, when you see someone who's lost 5 kilos, you haven't seen them for 6 months and you've lost all this weight, you're like, oh, how did you lose the weight? I mean, they never say, I don't know. I just found that when I went shopping, I just drifted away from the chocolate aisle. I don't know how it happened. It just that's not how it works. How did you lose the weight? Well, I had to go to the gym. I had to say no to some stuff so I could say yes to some other things. I had to make some choices. I mean, you'll never drift toward discipline. And so, growth and comfort never coexist, ever. Consistency is not comfortable, it's not easy, but it's the key to growth, but it's always an active process. Now, I was speaking at a fitness conference years ago in Melbourne, probably 3 years ago now, and I mean, just to picture this audience, this was, 350 personal trainers, so like everyone in the audience was sitting there in Lycra, and no one had coffee or like Mentos, it was all like protein shakes and the rest of it, so it's quite an intimidating audience to speak to. Talking at this fitness conference, the speaker before me, that was very interesting, because he was talking about the psychology of consistency from a business perspective, because for personal trainers, if their clients aren't consistent, it's not just that they don't get results, if the clients aren't consistent, they don't keep paying. I mean, the churn rate for gyms is massive. So I was talking about how do we get consistency in clients. And some of the things he shared from a scientific perspective were really interesting. I wanted to share a couple of principles with you as we finish our time together this morning. Because he said there are 3 keys to achieving consistency. When it doesn't come naturally to us as humans. And here are the 3 keys. Number one, he said this, you need to move before you're motivated. See, most of us are slaves to our emotions. We wait till we feel like doing something before we do it. And yet the challenge is, motion always precedes emotion. If you do the stuff, suddenly you feel like it afterwards. It's like when you need to call someone, a new prospect or a client that you haven't connected with for a few weeks, and you go, I really don't want to make this call. And the longer you put it off, the harder it gets. Then as soon as you make the call, if you go, okay, I'm just going to make the call, you hang up that call after you made the call, how do you feel? Great, motivated. You could make the next call. This is where momentum builds, by the way, because you make 1, then 2, then 5, then 7, and suddenly you're having a cracker of a day. But it's moving before you're motivated, not waiting till the motivation's there. So the difference between motivation and inspiration, we talked about inspiration before, you've got to have inspiration from the outset. Now, don't move until you're inspired. Because what inspiration's about, it's an orientation. Whereas motivation's about an emotion. They're different things. So you've got to be inspired first, but you don't have to be motivated first before you move. Just get it there, do the stuff, and allow the emotions to catch up. I love this insight from a guy who, Millard Fuller is his name, is the head or the founder of Habitat for Humanity. And those of you who got a copy of the book with a dinosaur in it, a portion of those books go to Habitat for Humanity every time you buy one. Interesting, Millard Fuller put it well. He said, you do not think yourself into a new way of acting, you act yourself into a new way of thinking. See, actions, that's what sets our emotional state. But most of us have it the wrong way around. We wait for the emotions to kick in. And by the way, it's easy to be fired up here. It's easy to be motivated while you're here, but when you go back home, how motivated are you going to be next Thursday or the following Tuesday? That's the time, if you're going to be consistent, you have to move before you're motivated. Now, I love the example. I don't know if Keith Abraham shared it when he was here with you 2 years ago, but he shared something with me probably last year when we were catching up, and I thought it was such a good example of this because he decided to get fit a few years ago. And he said the thing that was most helpful to get consistency for him, he just said he started to go to bed with his running clothes on. Did he talk about that when he was here? Did he mention that? Well, it's just a crack up because he said, like, honestly, he said, I'll go to bed wearing the full exercise clothes and the shoes in bed. He said, because what it meant, he said, it transformed it for him because it meant when I woke up in the morning, I was ready to go. Whereas he said, if I've just got pajamas on, I wake up and I've got to make some decisions before I'm in the clothes and then do the exercise. And I thought, it's not super romantic, Keith. But anyway, there you go. But this whole idea of how do you make sure you try and stack the deck so that you're ready to move and not waiting to make a decision until the motivation's there. Okay, number 2, second key is this. You need to get some early wins. Now, this is so important when you're beginning a new person, a new distributor in your team, that in the first few weeks, they get a sense of progress. That they get a sense of some wins on the board. It's so important to do that. Because without a sense of some wins, some forward progress, it's really hard to persist. Interesting piece of research looking at the importance of early wins. Wonder how many of you have got your wallet filled with a couple of these coffee cards. Who's got some coffee cards, some loyalty cards? Many of us have got the apps, the Rewardle apps and things like that now. But it's interesting, years ago there was a study done where a cafe was giving out coffee cards, and they would traditionally give out coffee cards that were empty and you'd stamp every time you bought a coffee and the 10th one was free. But the researchers did this. They had the cafe give out these cards, but instead of giving it out blank with just the first one for the first coffee, they pre-stamped three coffees. So when you got the coffee card, you were already a third of the way to getting your first free one. You hadn't even bought a coffee yet. And what was interesting is the people who got the pre-stamped cards were twice as likely to come back and with a much greater frequency than those who had the empty cards, because there's always this already a sense of, I've got a few wins, I'm already a third of the way there, I'll keep going back. Now, how do you do the same thing? We talked about progress before, and here's the key. Progress is the key to perseverance. You will not stick at something unless you feel like you're making gains. And they don't have to be big gains, there's got to be gains. You're going to feel like you're moving forward. The moment it feels like you're stuck and no matter what you do, nothing changes, that's when we give up. That's when consistency becomes especially difficult. And again, this is why goal setting is so important. I wonder how many of you have heard of these things. Jim Collins used to talk about having a BHAG. Who's heard of a BHAG before? Anyone familiar with that term? What does it stand for, Jeff? You know it? Big, hairy, audacious goal. It is the weirdest acronym I've ever heard, and yet people persist in talking about it. You got it right. Well done. But a BHAG, so Jim Collins said, for any business to stay at the cutting edge over the long haul, you've got to have a big goal, a big dreamer, the North Star that'll motivate you and draw you on. And having a BHAG is good. And by the way, a BHAG for some of you is the Caribbean. That's a big, hairy, audacious goal. 12 months out, it's exciting, it's inspiring, that's great. But you know what? Here's the challenge. BHAGs tend not to build momentum. Sorry, you're like, oh, really? I thought the Caribbean was it. No. That's helpful. But if you want to build momentum straight out of the gate from this weekend, the Caribbean's good, but it's too far away to motivate you in a sustained way. I was listening to a great podcast from a leadership expert and pastor in the US, Craig Groeschel, last year. Who knows Craig Groeschel's stuff? Anyone familiar with him? Love his stuff. And he said, if you want to build momentum in a team, he said, BHAGs are good, but what you actually need is a whole lot of S-bags. He said, S-bags stand for stretching but achievable goals. By all means, have the Caribbean as a goal 12 months out or 14 months out, however far away it is. But if you want to build momentum, you need to have a whole lot of S-bags. What's the goal you're going to set between now and next weekend? And the following Wednesday? And the following Tuesday? Because those stretching goals, I mean, you can see them, they're perceptible, they're going to require a bit of a stretch, but you can achieve them quickly and easily, and that's what gives you momentum. Newton's first law of motion tells us the hardest thing to do is get off go. It's called the law of inertia. But once you're moving, it's much easier to speed up. The beauty of S-bags is they get you off go. They give you that sense of forward movement. And that's where momentum forms. All right, what are we up to? Number three, pick a sustainable pace. Pick a sustainable pace. You know, when it comes to building momentum, it is not about the rate of your activity, it's the rhythm that counts. You would be far better in the next few weeks or the next few months if you want to build momentum to do insignificant things consistently than significant things sporadically. Like little things, just do them consistently rather than doing one or two big things and having a couple of days off. Because again, it's the rhythm, not the rate of activity that builds momentum. I love this insight from Jim Rohn. Eating 7 apples on a Sunday night will never be as effective as eating an apple every single day. And it's true. It's the consistency of small activities. So if you set the goal too high, the bar too high, and you can't stick at it, that's a challenge. Set the bar lower. Realistically, you can do little things every single day because it's that rate. It's the rhythm, not the rate. That's where momentum will form. Now for me, one of the highlights of my career was a few years ago, I had the chance to speak at a conference alongside someone who I've grown up reading from and listening to, a guy named John Maxwell. Now, how many of you love John Maxwell? Any fans of John Maxwell? It was interesting, I was at this conference over in the US, big event over there, and he was the other speaker, and we had a bit of a chance to hang out backstage, which was just cool, because as I said, I mean, growing up around this industry, I would have read my first John Maxwell book when I was about 9 or 10. Now, by the way, that's the stuff, isn't it, that your kids have, those of you who are parents, that their peers won't have. They'll grow up with a way of thinking that is uncommon. And that's the difference. In fact, how many of you know thank you water and thank you nappies and all that sort of thank you brand? So I've known Daniel Finn for a couple of years now. We were catching up on, I think it was Tuesday this week, he came over for dinner and I was surprised to learn that he was from a direct selling family too. And he said, I probably wouldn't have started thank you except for having the environment, the mentality to grow up around. Because you just grow up reading different stuff, thinking different things. And that's the power of this industry, by the way, and the environment your kids will be raised in. And how old are your kids? Just turned 5. You think of the gift of just what that kid will grow up with that most kids don't have, just a mentality and the access to information. And so for me, growing up around stuff like this, things like John Maxwell's material was great. So great to meet him, great to hang out with him. And something he said that day when we were speaking really stuck with me. He said this. He said, people need to realize they'll never change their lives until they change something they do on a daily basis. And that's the key part here, daily basis. Often in obscurity. Now, Jeff and I were talking about Elijah. Are you Elijah? No? Who's this, sorry?
Hi, Dan.
How are you? I saw you walking. You look like a swimmer, so I thought maybe you were the sun. Hi, Dan. Sorry to embarrass you. Anyway, so you're not Elijah. So, you know, we're talking about Elijah, who's just, was at the Commonwealth Games just a couple of months ago. And we're talking about, you know, in the swimming pool, and having done swimming all the way through my teens, that was sort of my frame of reference too. In the swimming pool, the sporting arena, and in business, the reality is public victories are always preceded by the private ones. You know, it's all those moments of getting up at 5. What time's morning training these days for him?
In the water at 5.
So up at about 4:30, probably something like that. I mean, that's a disgusting time of the day. I don't even think God's awake at that time of the day. It's a disgusting time of the day to be up. 4:30. But there you are, in the pool. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Those are the private victories. Everyone sees the moment on the podium. What they don't see is the private victories. It's the daily stuff. That's what John Maxwell talks about. If you change the daily things, the little things, that's when your results shift over time. It doesn't happen overnight, like the Pantene ad. Doesn't happen overnight, but it will happen. Okay? So the question is, for you, what are some of the routines that have the potential to revolutionize your results in the next 12 months? Because who would love to have an awesome next 12 months in your business? Hands up if you would. Most of us would. Okay. Be a shame if you said, no, not really, just keen to go. But okay, great year. You know what? Great years are made up of extraordinary months, which are made up of extraordinary weeks, which are made up of extraordinary days. It's the daily stuff compounded over time. That's where momentum's built. And the question I'd ask you to reflect on for a few moments is, what is one daily routine that could revolutionize your life and your effectiveness? Not just your business, but your life more broadly. And this, some of you know what this daily routine would be because you used to do it. Again, what was the question we asked before? What have you stopped doing? Most of us, there are things that we used to do back when we were in that sweet spot, but we forget about them. And typically, the sort of routines that transform our results fall into one of, how many categories here? We got five categories all up. Typically, it'd be one of these five. There was a sixth one, but I took it out. Typically, these five categories. They'll be, you know, routines that do with our mental acuity, our mental health, or stretching our minds. It might be reading every day or listening to a podcast every day or getting through a book a month or a book a week. I was chatting with a business leader last week. He reads 2 books a week. I'm like, wow. And he's a busy guy, but he said, I've got to keep stretching my brain. It might be physical, might be to do with exercise. It doesn't mean you have to be an Olympic swimmer, but just getting out and getting moving and feeling better and the flow on effect, that's huge. Might be relational routines. I mean, Barack Obama is a very interesting example. He was asked, just as before he left the White House, how he'd managed to keep his family together in the pressure of being president. And I'd often wondered the same thing. I mean, how do you have that job, the level of pressure, and still exit that time with a marriage that seems to be pretty flourishing, kids that seem to like you and doing well? And he said for him, the daily routine every day of dinner with his family, in the midst of everything going on as president of the U.S., it was in his diary. He said, when I was in Washington at the White House, he said, at dinner time, everything stopped.
I was unavailable. My phone was off. All the Secret Service people knew I was not to be interrupted unless it was absolutely critical. So that was just a daily routine. We had time as a family every day. And I thought it was just a good example of just little things, daily routines. Might be spiritual, might be prayer, might be fasting, might be time reading scripture or an inspiring book or something that's just going to keep you sharp. And again, you go back to a time in your life when you were really on fire. I bet there were times where you had daily routines that maybe you've let slip. It's not rocket science, it's little things. Might be professional, might be meeting with a mentor, networking, connecting with people. What are the things that will keep you at the cutting edge? So of those five, and it doesn't really matter which of the categories it's in, because here's the beautiful thing about momentum. If you develop a routine in one of these that builds momentum, it flows on to the others. Suddenly you're feeding your mind and you think, actually, you know, getting fit's not such a big ask. And having daily spiritual routines isn't a big ask. So the question I would ask you is, if there's one routine you could instigate in your life in the next month or reinstigate, what would it be? Now, let's just not talk up here about this. Be honest. Pop it on the paper. This is where it gets serious. I'm not going to single you out or ask you what it is. But for every one of you, I'd really strongly encourage you to leave here with something like, this is the daily routine I would love to instigate or reinstigate. Then that could revolutionize my results. I'll just give you 10 seconds to pop something down. We're almost out of time, so what I will do though is this. I want to give you a couple of questions to help you make good intentions become a reality. How do you make a routine stick? Okay. A couple of keys to doing this. Number one, you need to ask yourself this question. Looking at that routine, what action could I take immediately? What could I do? And we're not talking when I get home, once the conference is finished. What can you do before 3 p.m. today to get started? As we said, it's often just getting off go. That's the hardest thing. The secret to getting ahead is getting started. Mark Twain told us that. Yep, make a phone call. Might be clarifying exactly what this will look like on a daily basis. What is it? What's the one thing you can do to get started? So just maybe jot these questions down and spend some time as we go throughout the day reflecting on these five questions and how they apply to that routine. I love this insight here. Great old Chinese proverb. The best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. Often the thing that stops us setting routines in place is we think, oh, but I've lost so much time already. If only I'd done this 10 years ago. Well, you can't change that. All you can change is whether you do it today or not. I love that. So what immediate action can you take today to get started? Number two, what would the cost of action and inaction be? Two things. Cost of action. By doing this, by saying yes to this one thing, you have to say no to other stuff. What's the stuff you'll have to say no to? But also, what's the cost of inaction? If you don't do this, if you leave here and in the next few days you don't put this routine in place, in a month's time, or 6 months' time, or 2 years' time, or 10 years' time, what will you have foregone? What will you have missed out on? A mentor told me years ago, it was one of the most helpful pieces of advice I got when I was starting in business. He said, you'll always pay two prices in life. There's only the two you choose to pay. The beautiful thing is you get the choice of which one you pay. You either pay the price of discipline or the price of regret. That's it. They're the only two. Now, here's the catch. If you choose not to pay the price of discipline, you automatically pay the price of regret. I mean, discipline's not fun, but it's short-term, it's hard, and there's a result. Regret is long-term, and there's no end point. So what's the cost of action or inaction? Number three, what roadblocks might there be? What are the things that could get in the way that'll trip you up? Be sensible. Preempt this stuff. I mean, for me, years ago, a bit like Keith Abraham, I started to go to the gym a few years ago and get fit. And it's interesting that one of the things I discovered is over the years I had a few times of trying to set a daily or a weekly routine for gym attendance in place. And I thought, okay, why has it not worked in the past? What can I do differently this time? And this is how simple and dumb some of this stuff is. Okay, the last few times I'd had gym memberships I didn't stick at, why didn't I? Because I didn't have enough gym clothes. Like, honestly, I'd get there, I'd go, okay, I should go to the gym today. I'd check the drawer, oh, they're all dirty. Oh, what a shame, I won't go today. I have to go tomorrow, you know? And so I sat there and I thought, okay, that's been a roadblock in the past. That's why I haven't persisted with the gym. I'm like, there is a simple solution here. So I went to Kmart. Like, I thought, I don't even know if I'll stick with it yet, so I won't spend too much money on stuff. So I went to Kmart and spent, like, honestly, $35 and bought 3 sets of gym clothes. So I just removed the excuse. I've got plenty of options of gym clothes now. I mean, that's not an excuse now. And so what are the roadblocks? Just think, what are the things that could prevent me from sticking with this? Number four, what mental scripts might I need to change? What are the things you've told yourself about yourself that have been holding you back? Because our beliefs will always drive our behaviours. I mean, for me, for years, I told myself I wasn't the sort of person who liked going to gyms. Gyms are loud and full of vain people and all the rest of it. I just had a belief about gyms. So when I decided to start getting fit, I might have to challenge that belief. No, I actually am someone who flourishes in the gym. I enjoy it. It makes me feel alive and vibrant. Just shifted the belief. It's amazing the difference that makes. Number five, what rewards can you set in place to celebrate progress? And this goes to the point we touched on before. Progress is the key to perseverance. What can you set in place? Little markers along the way to give you a sense of forward movement. You know, treat yourself. It's amazing. It doesn't have to be a big deal. Just little things to give you a sense of forward movement and progress. That's what will keep you on track. All right. We are pretty much out of time. What I will do before we finish up, I'll just put my details up on the screen. There's a whole lot of things on the website that could be useful. There's a whole video channel, for instance, on our website with short clips that build on some of the things we've talked about today. So feel free to check that out if that would be of any value. I'll be around at lunch too. So if you've got questions, find me. I don't think you have to leave until halfway through the lunch break. So be good to chat further if you've got questions then. But, you know, just as we draw all this to a close, you know, we talked briefly before about New Year's resolutions. And January 1st, my Facebook feed was full of inspirational and motivational quotes and memes. Probably yours was a bit the same. This year, though, one meme stood out. The reason it stood out was because it was from someone who's not normally known for their commitment to physical health. It's a doctor who's more in the mental health game. And it was this meme here from Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil said this. He said, in a year's time, you're either going to weigh more or less than you do right now. Now, when I first saw this on Facebook on January 1st, I thought, what? I actually thought it was such an obvious, almost stupid statement. I read it a second time and a third time, thinking, I've missed something here. On the third reading, I thought, actually, this is not just a silly comment. There's actually profound truth in this. And it's actually the truth we started our time with, the law of entropy. I was going to say the law of inertia. The law of entropy tells us life has no pause button. Just as Dr. Phil's saying, in 12 months' time, in a year's time, you'll either weigh more or you'll weigh less than you do right now, depending on the decisions you make between now and then. I mean, it's scientifically impossible. Your weight will not fluctuate at all in the next 12 months. See, one of the greatest myths in life and in business is the myth of the plateau. This idea that I'll build it and then I'll just maintain at that level. There is no such thing as a plateau. The reality is you're either advancing or you're retreating. You're either growing or you're going backwards. You're either taking ground or you're losing it. Your business is either getting bigger or smaller. It is never plateauing. It is never staying the same. The law of entropy tells us it is scientifically impossible. And here's the great thing. You get to choose whether it's going to get bigger or smaller. More momentum or less. I mean, the things that build momentum, this is not rocket science. It's not hard. It does take effort, but it's remarkably simple. It's a simple formula, and I've seen it work for so many business owners. I hope this has been helpful. But the challenge now is it's up to you what you do with this stuff. So thank you again for the invite. Trust it's been useful. Enjoy the rest of your conference. Cheers.